From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM later tonight. What happens in a world that anticipates your every move? It's going to be a fascinating subject. But here's what's happening. Well, if you live in the Los Angeles area, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But listen to this, folks. A recent study has confirmed now what many already know, that Los Angeles has the worst traffic in the country. Los Angeles topped the charts for the most gridlocked city in 2013, according to what is called the annual traffic scorecard. Drivers in L.A. wasted an average of 64 additional hours a year behind the wheel due to traffic. My gosh. Private employers added fewer workers than expected in February, and services sector growth slowed. The latest signs that the severe weather continues to be a drag on the economy. The National Employment Report showed that private payrolls increased by 139,000 jobs last month. January's jobs report was revised sharply down to 127,000 from the previous reported 175,000. Let's check in with the investment advisor, Catherine Austin Fitz. Well, it's not a royal day in the old nation with jobs these days, Catherine.
George, if the official statistics were cheese, they'd be Swiss cheese because there's so many holes in it. Those are funny, funny statistics. I would say the real unemployment rate is much, much higher. And the way you can tell it is that our employment participation, workforce participation, is about 63%. It's the lowest it's been in 35 years. So, you know, this is a big structural problem, and it's going to get bigger before, you know, because if you look at all the things that need to get done, we haven't addressed them. You've got several things going on. You've got globalization, automation, and corruption all contributing to significantly reduced incomes in a, you know, just a broad class of groups in North America and the developed world. And you've got an education policy which has encouraged people to not get the skills they need to be relevant in the things that are growing, and a media, not including Coast to Coast, who've encouraged people to behave in ways that are not the entrepreneurial ways that will help them adapt. So we almost have a perfect storm, and we're going to have to change. But in the meantime, the pain is going to be great, and I'm afraid it's going to get greater.
Catherine, I talked to a couple of restaurateurs here out in the St. Louis area, and they told me that their January and February, the worst months they've ever had in years. I got to believe the weather had something to do with this, don't you?
The weather had you have a couple of things. One is that, you know, the growth has not come back to sort of the household income that, you know, the broad middle class that you need, number one. Number two, Obamacare, as you and I have talked several times, just wiped out the discretionary income of so many people. So Obamacare, you know, if you looked at the discretionary income that was supporting so many retail, both restaurants and stores, wham, it got all wiped out. And then, of course, we've had the weather on top, and it's January, February. The real test of how this year does is going to be spring. So you've almost had a perfect storm on top of a very deep structural issue. So it doesn't surprise me if that's what you're hearing. You know, I'm in the middle of the country, too. People are really hurting. I hate to say this. The parking lots at Walmart are empty. It's pretty spooky.
It is spooky. And one quick thing, Radio Shack shutting down 1,100 stores. Sign of the times, is it the internet or is it something else?
There's no doubt about it. You're seeing, and the weather contributed mightily to pushing people online. So you're seeing more and more happening online. We now, you know, a billion smartphones shipped last year, George. Let me just test you. Guess what the revenues at the App Store at Apple were in December?
I don't even want to guess.
$1 billion. And, you know, now the Apple App Store is getting more purchases from Asia. So retail's being reorganized by the fact we now have over 1.8 billion people on smartphones and tablets and computers accessing the internet, and it's really reorganizing and aggregating everything.
All right, Catherine, thank you so much. Catherine's website, solari.com, S-O-L-A-R-I. Well, the improper use of antibiotics is widespread and putting hospital patients at risk, according to a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The report found that doctors at some hospitals prescribed three times as much antibiotics as doctors at other hospitals to treat similar patients. And researchers found that in roughly one-third of the cases, the hospital prescriptions to treat all kinds of infections just truly out of control. People will be advised to half the amount of sugar in their diet under new World Health Organization guidance. Recommended levels of sugar will stay at below 10% of the total calorie intake a day, but below the 5% should be the target, they say. Consuming high levels of protein, particularly animal protein, is a bad strategy if you're at midlife and aiming to live into the old age bracket, according to new research. But a study reveals that in older age, fortifying one's diet with some more protein-rich foods appears to be a formula for extending your life. Well, let's check in with Dr. John McDougall, author of The Starch Solution. John, let's get your take, first of all, on midlife folks. Why can't they eat a lot of animal protein?
Well, I think all the discussion here is really good, and that is that people are starting to be aware that we do know the cause of people being sick. You know, it's specifically the study in cellular metabolism or cell metabolism said that if you want to prevent cancer and diabetes and, reduce your risk of dying, you need to get the animal foods out of the diet. I think it's important also what you mentioned about the sugar, but with all the internet communication, all the smartphones, all the information people are getting out there, there's a real positive note to this, George. We have a nation of very fat and sick people, and studies like this one in cell metabolism that focus on the fact that people are ill not just because of some genetic problem or, you know, some mysterious virus. It's because of all the dairy and the meat and the other rich foods and all this stuff that the animal food industries are encouraging people to eat. Now, when I tell you that, we've had this conversation before. A lot of your listeners are thinking, well, if, you know, I can't eat the chicken, I can't eat all the beef, mm-hmm. all the cheese because it increases my risk of cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and so on. What do I eat? Well, this is the simple message, and the one that fits in with the economy issue that you've been talking about, is people need to get back to the diet of traditional people. We've discussed this many times, a diet like the Asians used to eat. You know that in China, George, back before 1980, fewer than 1% of the population had diabetes. Today, in China, 12% of the population has diabetes. This, again, is not, you know, some kind of virus that people have caught. And studies like this one on cell metabolism that hit national headlines and allow the consumer to just think for a minute, there is something that they can do, and that is something specific, and that is to cut the protein out, not just the fat, not just the cholesterol, but the protein from animal foods out and replace it with traditional foods like rice and corn and beans. People trim right down. They reduce the risk of diabetes. It's just, you know, a simple economic solution.
Yet, John, it says for older people, increasing that protein-rich diet is good. So I don't understand.
Why is that?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's also true that in older people, you don't see cholesterol in terms of their blood cholesterol, giving cholesterol-lowering medications to be of benefit. And I tell you why I believe that is, George. It's because those that are sensitive to, say, too much protein, too much fat, and so on, they've all died off. You only leave the resilient people left that all of this cholesterol-rich, high-protein foods haven't affected. All of the general population has already been killed by this kind of diet, and you just have a few survivors left. So, you know, it shouldn't give anybody pause to say, well, you know, we're just killing men and women below 65 with these high-protein foods and say, well, you know, for older people, it's okay to eat these high-protein foods. It's just that, you know, they've killed off all the people who are sensitive to eating all these animal foods already. And that's why I believe you're seeing this apparent contradiction.
All right, John. John's website is drmcdougall.com. You'll find that on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Well, another asteroid flew past the planet just inside the orbit of the moon. We were in no danger of a collision this time. Italy says it will unblock millions of dollars in emergency funding to save the ancient city of Pompeii after flooding caused walls to collapse. A number of structures, including the Temple of Venus in Roma, were damaged by heavy rainfall on Sunday and Monday, the site where volcanic ash smothered a Roman city back in AD 79 has suffered destruction for many, many years. Well, a long time ago, there was an American author who wrote some incredible novels, including Grapes of Wrath, John Steinbeck. He died at the age of 66, but some say he was involved in much more than writing. We'll check in with Brian Kinnaird in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Okay, author John Steinbeck, of course, he's dead. He died in 1968, was an American author of 27 books, including 16 novels, 6 nonfiction books, 5 collections of short stories, widely known for the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel The Grapes of Wrath, East of Eden, and the novella Of Mice and Men. And Steinbeck received the Nobel Prize for Literature back in 1962 for all the things that he has done. But what else did he do? Was he just an author? Well, Brian Kinnaird has done a lot of research after pursuing a degree in finance and economics at David Lipscomb University. Brian ran a small business for 3 years and entered the world of corporate management. He is a 32nd degree Scottish Rite Freemason, and he writes the esoteric theme blog Grail Seekers. We'll talk with him about that as well. But here's an incredible story. I want you to sit back and listen. Brian's with us for a couple hours. First of all, Brian, welcome to Coast to Coast. It's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on, George.
Now, tell me a little bit about your interest of the late author John Steinbeck and how that all occurred.
It occurred really by happenstance. Around 2007, I got on the kick of rereading the classics. I was in a used bookstore and was perusing Hemingway and Steinbeck's works. I noticed Steinbeck had written a book called The Acts of King Arthur and His Noble Knights, which was his rewrite of Thomas Mowry's L'Amour d'Arthur, which is the core of Arthurian legend and Holy Grail legend. And those things have always interested me. So I picked up the copy and I started finding out how Steinbeck got interested in this. And after a few months of research, I contacted John's only remaining son, Thomas. And we spoke for about an hour about John's love of Grail lore and what he thought of the Holy Grail and a number of other things. And I began to figure out there was an untold story about Steinbeck and his love of Arthurian lore, because it's kind of glossed over in his biographies. So I started taking trips to places like the New York Public Library Special Collections Department and Stanford University's Letter Archives to try to locate letters and other mementos from the time period he was writing this. And another picture began to evolve of Steinbeck. In and amongst my other interests of his, I found out that he worked for the OSS during World War II. While he was a war correspondent in 1943, he was with Douglas Fairbanks Jr. in a prototype SEAL-type unit called the Beach Jumpers, which was an ultra-top secret unit, and had actually gone into combat with them. I'd also found out that a number of the publications that Steinbeck wrote for after World War II also were implicated by Carl Bernstein in his 1977 Rolling Stones article, the CIA and the media, with Operation Mockingbird. So,
well,
the picture
let me say, though, that in your book, Steinbeck, Citizen Spy, which, by the way, you've done a good job with that, Steinbeck, wasn't he, and correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, wasn't he an ultra-left type person?
He was an ultra-left type person, and because of the Grapes of Wrath, people thought that he had communist tendencies, which was really nowhere near the truth. A good example of that is in June of 1950, he wrote a letter to his friend Bo Badeski, who was a Swedish painter, that says, "I can't think of words can solve things, but somehow we must stop this thing or the world will be done and gone into a black chaos that makes the dark age shine, referring to communism. So it's pretty apparent from a lot of John's letters and speaking with his son, Steinbeck was an anti-communist, and very ardently so. According to Thomas, John really didn't have a problem with American-style communism because they couldn't get out of bed in time to make rallies. But the Soviet-style Stalinist communism that exterminated the lives of 20 million people, kiboshed any creative thought coming out of the Soviet Union, that bothered Steinbeck immensely. So this was his foray into fighting the Cold War.
Now, when he was doing this, and he, you know, there were rumors that he, you know, went to the CIA and that they, you know, welcomed him with open arms. Was this a great secret at the time?
Oh, of course it was. During that time period, we have to remember the CIA in the early 1950s is in its infancy. The intelligence community of the United States really developed in World War II with the OSS and a few other departments and grew into the CIA. And at their infancy, the CIA was underfunded. They had the job of now predicting future wars. If you think about intelligence gathering before World War II, it was all reactionary. But the speed of combat changed so much the need for intelligence. You know, you think about even Civil War. You have mass troop movements that could take weeks, and intelligence had time to catch up with the battlefield. Well, in World War II, that changed totally. You might have days, if that, to assess a threat. So the CIA was tasked with being predictive, and they really didn't know how to do that. And one of the things that they did was they recruited average people. And once again, we have to remember that these are part of the greatest generation.
That's right.
10 to 12% of American males were in uniform just a few years before. A lot of them have very highly specialized skill sets that would be attractive to a fledgling intelligence agency. And I was fortunate enough to speak with a former CIA intelligence officer who served from the Eisenhower to early Reagan administration. And he called them walk-ins. And what would happen would be if you had, say, an aerospace engineer who was going to a conference in Copenhagen, he would might contact the CIA and say, hey, I'm going to do this. Is there anything I need to look for? And a lot of the time, the agency would task them with speaking with certain people or being on the lookout for things that you and I wouldn't even notice. Like if there's a certain type of boxcar you see while traveling through this country, report back to us.
Yeah.
Or meet somebody here and give them this message. And sometimes the CIA would actively recruit these people, and sometimes they wouldn't, once again, be volunteers. Like
were they paying some of these people, though, Brian, other than being volunteers? I mean, or was it just for love of country that they did what they did?
Some of both, but a vast majority of these people were just volunteers. And they saw this as their way to further serve their country as they had during the Second World War.
There's always been talk that the CIA recruited Elvis Presley. Did you find anything like that in your research on Steinbeck?
No, I didn't find anything out about Presley. Although in my first book, Skullduggery, 45 True Tales of Disturbing the Dead, I do talk about the attempt to steal his body after he died. But nothing CIA-related with Elvis. But it wouldn't surprise me. Celebrities are in a unique position to, just like journalists, to
That's right.
speak to a vast number of different people. They're naturally inquisitive. they have doors open to them that you and I really don't have, or your average tourist wouldn't have.
Hold on for a second, Brian. We're going to come back. We'll talk more about this incredible story of John Steinbeck, the work Steinbeck, citizen spy. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, I'm going to invite all of you to download, if you have a smartphone, to download our free apps for the iPhone and the Android. Simply go to the coasttocoastam.com, click the store, and take those apps, and they should be on all your phones. We're going to have an announcement for those of you in Canada who have had problem getting apps. We're working on something for you, so you stand by there. And also some great news for you Coast Insiders. As you know, you can download the past 3 years of programs. We are working on the past 5 years of programs. We're going to open that up for you, and they're working on it as I speak. I don't know how long it'll take, but it's going to happen. 5 years of past programs, and I hope you can continue to build your library. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Brian Kennard with us. He is one of the authors of Steinbeck, Citizen Spy. Brian, do you want to give accolades to, I think you have, what, two other partners, co-writers on that book?
Well, actually, Thomas Steinbeck, John's son, wrote a bit of the foreword, and I have to give props to my editor, Alice Sullivan, who is integral to the process.
Well, good for you. Now, let's talk a little bit about the CIA and their mission at the time, what they were up to then, and of course, I think it's a different CIA today, but, you know, getting people like a noted Pulitzer Prize winning author, Steinbeck, to do what he did. What do you think, first of all, was Steinbeck's motivation to do this?
Well, like I said earlier, there's a misconception of Steinbeck that he was a liberal, but being a liberal doesn't take you away from being a patriot. And Steinbeck was ardently patriotic. And he was denied service during World War II, ostensibly because of those same thoughts that he had connections to the Communist Party. And he couldn't get a commission in the Army. He couldn't get even drafted in the Army during the war. So I think that this was John's way to serve equally as his compatriots had done during the Second World War. And his son Thomas agrees that, that would have been John's prime motivation. He simply wanted to do his part.
How long did he continue working with the CIA? Up until his death?
I believe at least until 1964, on his third trip to the Soviet Union. Even later than that, with his junket to Vietnam at the behest of Lyndon Baines Johnson. In the book, I looked at the years from pretty much 1940 until 1964, because at some point you've just got to quit writing.
Right. So you could be writing forever.
I really could. There's tons of evidence out there, and fortunately and unfortunately, looking at anything covert or in the intelligence community, you kind of have to look at it like finding extrasolar planets in the early days before we turned Hubble to some of those places. You have to look for the anomalies and pulsars to see the planets going around the star. Right. And the same thing holds true with the lives of spies. You look at the oddities in their lives, and Steinbeck has a ton of them. Not to mention, of course, all the documentation I was able to dig up.
You, of course, you're a Freemason. Steinbeck was a Freemason. I've got to tell you, Brian, we get so many calls from people who believe that Freemasons are involved in all kinds of things. You know, you're part of the Illuminati and everything else. Tell me a little bit about Freemasonry. I mean, are you guys as sinister as people think?
Not unless you consider having pancake breakfast to support our lodge and having very boring stated meetings being sinister.
Exactly. And you support the Shriners Hospital too, don't you?
Yeah, well, yes. All Shriners are Masons, but not all Masons are Shriners. It's a a sub-organization within Masonry, just right in the Scottish Rite Art. And the Shrine does great work with their burn hospitals. Scottish Rite operates a number of hospitals, one in Dallas in particular. But Freemasonry is primarily a charitable organization that is designed to make good men better. And yes, we have secrets, and they're not sinister secrets. Most anybody can do an internet search these days and find out what the great secrets of Masonry are. But the whole point of it is to have a brotherhood and a place where you can voice your own opinions and do these good works and have shoulders to lean on in your everyday lives. I mean, some of my brothers are some of my best friends that I've known for years and years and years and years. And there's nothing more sinister going on in any lodge than the Rotarians or the Lions Club. Why we get the bad rap, I'm not real sure, but there you have it.
In your research and in the book Steinbeck's Citizen Spy, for you, Brian, as a writer and researcher, what did you find to be probably one of the most startling aspects of Steinbeck?
Well, one of the most startling aspects that most everybody will not believe is, according to his son Tom, John Steinbeck was the most well-armed person that Tom ever knew. And Tom was a Vietnam veteran. John actually had a number of canes, and he always would walk with a cane. He had an injury in 1947 where he fell off a second-story balcony. It was right before he went to Russia in 47 to write a Russian journal or collect the material for a Russian journal. And he walked with a cane the rest of his life, or carried one. And some of those canes were actually concealed weapons. Tom told me that before he went to Vietnam, John gave him a Derringer and a cane that was a concealed 410 shotgun.
Oh, boy.
And that John also had sword canes, and he had briarwood canes that had big balls on the end, at the crook of them, that were full of lead shot. So if Steinbeck wasn't a spy, he certainly was armed like one.
What was he scared of to have that kind of weaponry?
Well, Tom really wasn't sure himself, but let's think about it. Steinbeck was a rich man. So you have not only the problems of a wealthy person walking around New York on a daily basis. He could get knocked on the head and ransomed just like any other wealthy person. But you also have the aspect of him being an intelligence agent for the agency. And there's an inherent danger there, no matter what level of service that he performed. So I think it was a myriad of reasons. And I think John just thought it was kind of neat to have. He was that type of person that would have thought, you know, a 410 shotgun cane, that's pretty cool. I need that. So.
And, you know, as we were talking about the CIA, you know, recruiting celebrities and journalists, I spent 9 years in the Navy, and I remember, you know, my ethnicity is Middle Eastern, and I speak a little Arabic. I remember when I was in my late 20s, Brian, I was a journalist, television executive. I seriously wanted to also join the CIA because of my personal background. And mm-hmm. I had made a call or two, and there was some interest in that, and then I never pursued that. But I can see how they, you know, rounded up these people, and again, for love of country, because that's so critical, that these people really wanted to do this. What I find ironic about people, though, like John Steinbeck, is that he really didn't come across, did he, as for love of country. He may have always had that, but he always came across as something different. And as you said earlier, you know, a lot of people thought maybe, you know, this guy has some communist ties. He's He was never called before the House Select Committee, right, on American Activities? And that's interesting that he was not.
Well, that's correct. He never was. And that's been one of the great mysteries about Steinbeck's life for his biographers. And most of his biographers account that or attribute that to there just wasn't enough evidence to call him in front of the committee. Well, that's not quite true. There are any number of ways that Steinbeck should have been called in front of HUAC, but never was. He had a number of connections with people that were either blacklisted or graylisted. And being graylisted was there was a number of publications that weren't government publications at the time that would out communists. And one of them was called Red Channels. And Steinbeck's good friend Burgess Meredith was outed by Red Channels for contributing to a relief effort in Yugoslavia. I mean, this was to buy food and clothes for kids, and Red Channels deemed him a communist because of it.
And I think they nailed Zero Mostel as well, I think.
And Burl Ives.
They got them all.
Well, exactly. And Elia Kazan was another great friend of Steinbeck's who actually testified against a number of people that he knew was in the Communist Party. And one of the interesting things I found out, in 1952, after Kazan had testified, Steinbeck was in Europe at the time on the trip with one of the letters that I got from the CIA that we might get into a little later. But he's writing his editor and talking about Kazan, and he says, you know, one never knows what they're going to do in that situation. And this is a direct quote. He says, "I'll never know. Isn't that strange?" Well, how could Steinbeck in 1952, at the height of McCarthyism, know that he would never be called in front of HUAC? Well, because he had CIA protection, of course. There are other instances where Steinbeck was the first person in Hollywood to try to hire one of the Hollywood Ten to write a screenplay, Ren Gardner. He tried to contract him to write a screenplay for Pastures of Heaven, which was a short story collection. Yeah. And the motion picture industry shut that down because at the time, Gardner was appealing his contempt of Congress charge, but the motion picture union said, no, if there's even a hint that someone is a communist, we're not working with them. So Steinbeck's continually poking the bear as far as HUAC's concerned. Even to the point that Roy Cohen and David Shine went to Europe in, this was 54, I believe, and cleaned house of all the libraries of the State Department of communist literature. And that included works of Longfellow and people that you wouldn't expect, but also of Steinbeck and Dashiell Hammett, of detective noir fame. And as soon as they got back, they called Hammett in front of HUAC, but Steinbeck wasn't. But that only goes to enrich his cover, so to speak.
Brian, we've always heard stories that Hollywood would do movies based on leaked information from government agencies. So, you know, maybe movies on UFOs and ETs and things like that. It was the government's way of trying to let us know things without telling us. And people thought, okay, they go to a Hollywood producer like a Steven Spielberg, and then Steven does these great movies. In those days, did the CIA ever go to people like Steinbeck and say, write this book or write this short story?
I believe that there are a number of articles that Steinbeck wrote, especially for Collier's Magazine in 1952, that were specific propaganda pieces. One was called Soul and Guts of France, where he visits a small village in France in the wine country. And it really is the most un-Steinbeck thing that Steinbeck ever wrote. He actually calls the people that live in the small village peasants. And it's written kind of from the perspective of somebody, if you hadn't read Grapes of Wrath, you would have thought that Steinbeck would have written Grapes of Wrath panning the Joads because they couldn't keep up with their loan payments. And Steinbeck talks about these French people, about how the kids didn't have shoes, but the great American author was coming, and the parents found money for shoes for the kids. And it turns into a defense of Matthew Ridgway, or General Matthew Ridgway, who had taken over NATO a few weeks before, and the French were very opposed to this. And the French also at the time were thinking about pulling out of NATO, which scared the Americans to no end. So Steinbeck is writing this from the perspective of, we still need to support the French. We still need to put money into the Marshall Plan kitty for Europe, because who knows what these bumpkins are going to do. Another book that he wrote was The Short Reign of Pepin the Fourth, which it was the only political satire novel that Steinbeck ever wrote, and that was in 57 or 58. And it describes the return of the Merovingian line to the throne of France, and has kind of this background of political intrigue and satire, because the French government was a mess after World War II. From, I believe it was 1945 to like 1960, they changed governments 22 or 23 different times, you know, just as much as we change socks. And Steinbeck was pointing out how ludicrous this was. But also, oddly enough, at the same time that Steinbeck was writing this, we have a shadowy organization popping up in France known as the Priory of Zion that the CIA definitely would have known about. And it's always made me wonder, and I address this in the book, if the agency didn't clue in Steinbeck to the Priory, and that's why he chose a Merovingian to return to the throne of France.
In his book, Grapes of Wrath, was he the main character? Were we reading his story in that book, even though it was fiction?
There's been a lot of debate about that. Right before he really got cranking on the Grapes of Wrath, writing it, there's a gap of time that supposedly Steinbeck took the same trip down Route 66. Whether that's true or not is up to debate, but Steinbeck was definitely going out to the migrant farms and talking to people and getting involved with their plight. I mean, to the point that Eleanor Roosevelt, when touring migrant farms, actually wanted to meet Steinbeck. This was either right before or right after Grapes of Wrath was published. So Steinbeck was kind of making some noise about that then. And I don't necessarily think that it was his story, but I think it was like a lot of his other stories, that he would write about people and places that he knew about. So from that perspective, it would be biographical, I guess.
What did his son Thomas think of the book?
Thomas enjoyed the book immensely. I had written the manuscript before I even talked to Thomas. This was February of last year. I got to a point where I thought that it was workable enough that I could send him a copy, and got in touch with him, and actually spoke with his wife, Gail, who's a great gatekeeper and manager of Thomas's affairs. And we spoke for 45 minutes, and I explained to her what I was doing and what I'd found out. And she was pretty taken aback by all this, but she said, I can see that. And she said, you need to talk to Tom about this. I'll have him call you in a couple of days. And sure enough, a day or so later, Tom calls me. And I start into my spiel about the letters I received from the CIA and the things I found out in Steinbeck's FBI file, and the FBI destroying portions of Steinbeck's FBI file. And I go on for about 20 minutes, and Thomas doesn't say anything.
Hold on right there, Brian. Hold on right there. We'll come right back to that point, and we're going to take some phone calls with you when we come right back. Our guest, Brian Kinard, we're talking about his work, Steinbeck, Citizen Spy.